Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
And NPR.
We're going to start the show with this fellow. His name's Ben Zimmer. He's the on-language columnist
for the New York Times Magazine.
Because we figured, since we wanted to do a show called...
Oops.
Right. We thought we should call Ben. And so he came into the studio and he brought with him a bunch of his favorite oopses.
As an example, I just wanted to give one of my favorite examples of...
The first one that he hit us with began its life. Was it in an AP news article?
Well, it was an AP story, but the AP story was fine. When the AP story appeared on a news site from the American Family Association...
Which, by the way...
...is a conservative Christian group. The headline, first of all, said, "Homosexual eases into 100 final at Olympic trials." And then,
was it kissing guys or something that they would be good at?
Well, if you read on, if you're confused by that headline,
very.
Here's how it starts. Tyson, homosexual, easily won his semifinal for the 100 meters at the U.S. Olympic track and field trials. And it goes on to say, you know, throughout the entire article, you know, on Saturday, homosexual misjudged the finish in his opening heat. The entire article had the word homosexual in place of gay. The sprinter's name is Tyson Gay.
Oh, my God.
According to Ben, this is a classic.
A classic example of...
a search and replace oops. This group apparently did not like the word gay.
Because gay makes homosexuality sound very nice and...
Very gay.
Very gay, right?
So what they did was they ran a search and replaced every instance of the word gay with the word homosexual. But then you get Tyson Gay becoming Tyson homosexual.
This was just one that they were a little careless with.
Just to be fair, here's a contrasting example. In 1990, the Fresno Bee ran an article
about the Massachusetts budget crisis, and it made reference to new taxes that will help put Massachusetts, quote, back into the African American. And they had to issue a correction saying it should have said back in the black.
No, this one might have been a newsroom prank. We're not sure.
But it did get into the paper.
Right. Just for the hell of it, here's one last one. This one happened after the famous broadcaster Walter Cronkite died.
When the Chicago Tribune did their online obituary for Cronkite, what happened was every instance of Cronkite got replaced by Mr. Cronkite. You can understand the thinking behind that. They're deciding, okay, for deceased males, they should be referred to with the title Mr. But then what this turns into is an obituary where it says he was born Walter Leland Mr. Cronkite Jr. And it refers to his radio show, Walter Mr. Cronkite's 20th Century. It's got things about his family, his son, Walter Mr. Cronkite III, his daughter, Kathy Mr. Cronkite.
Oops. My heart went oops.
I'm Jad.
The moment that we met, my heart went oops.
And I'm Robert.
I never will forget.
My on this episode of Radiolab,
the moment that I met you.
Four oopses, starting with a tree that
went oops.
Then we've got a goose that went
oops.
And an entire town that
went oops.
And a Harvard professor
that really went oops.
Yeah.
Now, we should just say before we start, oops is Oops can be a misleading term. Really what we're talking about here is something Greek.
Well, you try hard to prevent one thing and then you get exactly what you didn't want to get back at you.
Right, and our first story falls into that category. Back a few seasons ago, we were doing a show on deception. And we ended up talking with a professor named Ruben Gur.
Hello?
Hi, is this Professor Gur?
Yes, speaking.
He's a psychiatrist, works at the University of Pennsylvania. And I'd called him to talk about his research on self-deception. It's fascinating stuff, and I'm not going to go into it now, because somewhere along the way, the conversation took a really weird turn.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Get out.
Yeah, yeah.
And it happened when he began to tell me about some studies.
Strange studies.
Done by a, what was the guy's name?
His name is hanging on, I don't remember, in a second. Murray was his name.
Henry Murray.
And the reason we want to hear about Henry Murray is what?
What? I built it up. Don't you want to know more?
Not yet, no. Well, tell me more.
Okay, I'm going to let it unfold because we were so interested in what Ruben Gur told us that we found a guy.
Hey. Hi. How's it going?
Who knows a whole lot about Professor Murray's name is Alston Chase.
Very windy day today, isn't it?
And he lives in a remote cabin in Montana.
In the woods?
In the foothills.
Okay.
Professor Murray was a very prestigious scholar. He had been a professor of psychology at Harvard before the Second World War. During the war, he went to work for the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the forerunner of the CIA.
And a couple of years into his government service, says Alston, something happened that really spooked him and spooked the country.
During the Korean War,
there were some GIs, he said, who'd been captured in Korea, and afterwards,
after the Korean War,
they refused to come home.
They appeared to have betrayed their country,
renounced their own country, and disappeared behind Red China's bamboo curtain.
Does anybody want to go home?
No!
The CIA and their military establishment was very much concerned that the communists had found techniques for brainwashing.
And so Murray and other psychiatrists in the government were charged with preparing those soldiers to resist that kind of brainwashing. And Murray himself developed a style of interrogation.
Stressful interrogation was the term used.
That the Army could use on its pilots.
Yeah, he developed this method of kidnapping them before they were sent on the mission.
And then, says Ruben Gur, he'd run them through a battery of tests.
To see if they break. And if they didn't break, then they were fine to fly.
This kind of psychological training was kind of a new front in the Cold War. And in the 1950s, Murray's back at Harvard, and he's thinking of ways to fine-tune his techniques. And this is where things get interesting.
He took a class of Harvard undergraduates, 20-some-odd.
Sophomores, mostly.
The students were told to write an autobiographical essay.
Like a diary. And he told them, you know what?
Make it very personal.
Write your deepest thoughts in there.
Highest aspirations and hopes.
And while you're at it, write about your sexual fantasies. Go ahead.
Quite a class.
And after the students were done, he said to them, now I'm going to pair you up into groups of two.
To debate or discuss what they'd written.
Students were like, okay, we'll share. No big deal. But
they were duped. They were walked into this very brightly lit room,
which turned out to be an interrogation room with a one-way mirror.
Put in a chair, strapped in. Electrodes were attached to their arms, chest, their heart.
To measure stress, basically.
And they were also filming through the mirror.
And then, instead of a classmate, in walked a total stranger.
Older man.
This guy was holding their essay. They didn't know it, but Murray had trained him.
To do everything he could to anger and humiliate the undergraduate.
And he just tore them apart, piece by piece.
Using the essay to mock the students' aspirations and thoughts. Then, after this was done, the students have to come back week after week to view themselves on film, being humiliated.
That, to me, seems like the worst part. After they'd been humiliated, they had to watch themselves being humiliated over and over.
People became tearful and miserable, and he was proud how he destroyed people.
What kind of a person is this?
Like, why did he do it?
Yeah.
Why Murray did it? There are any one of a number of explanations, and they all could be true. One is it was a grant grabbing. He was getting money to do these things.
Also, you know, this was the Cold War. He was fighting communism. He may have thought it was justified.
Yeah, but he just said he was proud of this.
Well, it also happens to be the case that he was having an affair.
For about 30 years with a woman, not his wife, and they had a sexual relationship that bordered on the sadomasochistic, in fact, was sadomasochistic. In other words, Murray's interest in these was intensely personal.
Whatever the case, in those Harvard experiments, there was one student who was just not prepared for any of it.
His code name was Lawful.
Lawful. They gave each of these students a code name.
Because he was considered so conventional.
He was
really still just a boy.
Graduated high school at 16.
Was living 1,000 miles from home, 2 shirts and 2 trousers to his name.
And Lawful? Apparently was an especially lonely kid.
The notes I found of Murray did refer specifically to Lawful's essay, which he saw as highly alienated.
So when Lawful walked into that room, sat across from that stranger...
The guy really did a job on him. He was young, so he was barely growing a beard. So the first thing that the guy tells him is, what is this on your chin? Something trying to look like a beard?
Then the guy opens up Lawful's essay and lets him have it. Meanwhile, like all the students, Lawful had been hooked up to all these stress monitors.
I analyzed his data compared to all the other participants, and he had far and away the strongest response physiologically.
You mean like his heartbeat the fastest
heartbeat,
and all that?
Heartbeat, everything, through the roof.
Amazingly, this experiment went on for 3 years. And decades later, a lot of the subjects were still upset.
And considered it one of the most traumatic experiences they'd had in their 20s.
Lawful never forgot it.
That's right. He was resentful at the way he was treated at Harvard. He had nightmares about Professor Murray after he left Harvard.
So what happened to this guy?
Well, he finished up his 4 years at Harvard, got his degree, then got a PhD in math. Then he began to teach math. And then he became a household name.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean this.
The FBI raid began just after noon in a remote mountainous area called Stemple Pass, about 5 miles outside the town of Lincoln, Montana.
Turns out that Lawful's real name?
Theodore Kaczynski.
No.
Oh, yeah.
For Kaczynski was known.
Get out.
Yeah.
The FBI dubbed him the Unabomber. In nearly 18 years, he found targets all over the country.
His meticulously made bombs have killed 3 people and injured another 23.
Blew my arm off to the side like this. And the first thing I thought was, why did they do that?
Do you think that this study had anything to do with Ted Kaczynski's subsequent very infamous acts?
Well, I think he probably would have, if it hadn't been for that experiment, he still probably would have been maybe reclusive, living somewhere in a cabin in Montana, regardless. But I think the evil twist was done there.
Years later, while he was researching a book, Alston Chase corresponded with Kaczynski.
In one of his letters, he mentioned that he participated in some psychological experiments conducted by Professor Murray. Of course, I was very curious, and I wrote it back to tell me a little bit more about it, and he said, well, you really don't... I don't know if you want to go into that can of worms.
Reuben Gore is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, and Alston Chase is the author of the book Harvard and the Making of the Unabomber.
Oops, my heart went oops. Oops.
Here's one more from Ben Zimmer. What is the Cupertino effect?
The Cupertino effect is the name given to the phenomenon of when you rely on a spell checker too much, it will give you a suggestion. And very often, it's a suggestion that you really shouldn't take.
Why is it called the Cupertino effect?
Well, in early spell checkers, if you wrote cooperation, the word cooperation, C-O-O-P-E-R-A-T-I-O-N, a perfectly typical spelling of the word cooperation, in early spell checkers, that word was not there because it expected you to spell it C-O hyphen. And so what it would do is it would give you a suggestion, and the suggestion was Cupertino, the name of the town in California. So if you look at documents that are still online from the UN, from the EU, from NATO, you'll find dozens and dozens of Cupertinos that have found their way in there. For instance, here's a German NATO officer was quoted as saying, "The Cupertino with our Italian comrades proved to be very fruitful." And then there was a proposal from the EU's Scientific and Technical Research Committee. They proposed, quote, "stimulating cross-border Cupertino."
Oops, number two, you go.
The next one is just a different flavor entirely. We're going to meet someone. I don't know. I can't really say that he did anything wrong.
It's yeah, just like, I mean, this one is more like... Like, would you say luck?
I mean, suppose you just picked up a toothbrush and it was connected to a snake that was connected to a monster that was connected to the devil himself. I mean, you wouldn't know. You're just picking up a tooth. So this is a case where really bad things happen. The story comes from our own reporter, Pat Walters.
Yeah.
It concerns... Well, I don't know. You go ahead. And...
Okay. So just to start, I want you to imagine you're on a mountaintop.
Okay.
This mountain is in western Nevada.
The second highest peak in the state of Nevada.
Got a name?
It's called Wheeler Peak. And...
Who's this?
This is Michael Cohen.
I go by Michael P. Cohen.
He's a nature writer. And he tells me that up on top of this mountain...
There is a grove of old trees. And you can see the trees from a distance, and their wood is so bright that it actually glistens in the sun.
What are they called?
Oh, bristlecone pines.
Yes.
Can you describe what they look like?
Sure. They tend to be shorter, broad at the base. They get very, very old. And as they get old, they become tortured or gnarled.
They sort of twist up towards the sky.
The overall effect is sort of electrical.
They look kind of like what you'd see in a Tim Burton movie. So you have that picture?
Yeah.
In your mind?
Yep.
Okay, so the story is about this scientist named Don Curry.
I'm going to take a drink of water. Okay.
Story starts in 1964.
Don Curry was a graduate student from North Carolina, and he was young.
Do we know how old he was?
He was 30 years old.
And he'd just gotten a big grant from the National Science Foundation to do some climate change research. Not like climate change now, though. Climate change thousands of years ago. Because he'd learned that you could actually sort of travel back in time.
Go back into the past using the spacing between tree rings, the annual rings.
This is Ron Lanner. He's a retired Forest Service scientist. And he says you can use the width of the tree rings
to determine whether it was colder at one time or rainier at one period in the tree's life or whatever.
So Curry's up on top of this mountain, up amongst these trees, and he needs to find one that he can look inside and kind of see what the weather was like way back in the
past.
5 minutes of looking is all that was involved.
This is from a NOVA documentary. Curry died a few years ago. And this is actually the only time that he ever talked about this story on tape.
Literally.
He found a tree there.
The first old tree that we climbed to.
That he described as looking super, super old.
So Curry takes out this special drill, which scientists use to take like a core sample to look at the rings.
Yeah.
He presses it up
against the tree. Give it a good push to get it through the bar.
And he starts twisting it in.
Clockwise into the tree. But he wasn't having much luck.
The normal approach to coring the tree wasn't working.
It becomes harder and harder for him to turn this thing into the tree.
And eventually, the bit of his drill broke off in the tree.
Ooh.
This isn't just any drill. He ordered it from Sweden. The whole time he's thinking, if I can't get this thing out of the tree...
That would mean the research project would be lost for the year.
So at this point...
He kind of lumbers back down the mountain.
And...
Dejected.
He managed to find the district ranger and told him the problem.
Guys, my drill, it got stuck in the tree. What should I do? And they tell him, don't worry about it, Don. We'll just
cut the tree down.
This is one tree. There are dozens of these trees all around.
So
they start slicing into the tree. It takes a while to cut it down because it's really dense, full of knots and gnarls. And eventually the tree falls over.
Then they cut some slabs out of the lower part of the tree.
Curry gets one of these slabs back to his lab, throws it on a big desk, finds a magnifying glass, because the rings are really small, and he starts counting. One, two, three. And as he counts, he's making little
pinholes or pencil marks every 50 or 100 years.
317. By the end of the first day, he gets back to 1,000 years. Like the Dark Ages were in Europe eating raw possum. Day two, 2006. By the middle of the day, he gets back to like Jesus, Roman Empire, gladiators, and centurions. But even at that point, he was only like halfway finished. He kept counting.
We could begin to see that we were getting over 4,000 years, over 4,500, over 4,600, and we ended around 4,900 years.
It had 4,844 annual rings in it.
And at that point, the oldest tree that anyone had ever found was 4,600 years old. In other words,
he had himself the oldest tree ever.
But he had killed it.
And you've got to think, I've got to have done something wrong. I better recount again.
But no matter how many times he counted the rings, the number never went down. The world's oldest tree was dead.
It was horrifying. It was like a family tragedy.
People had given these trees names.
There was Buddha and Socrates and
Methuselah.
They'd called Curry's tree
the Prometheus tree.
And the guy who named that particular tree was so angry that he wrote a magazine article where he called Don Curry a murderer.
All across the country, there was a tremendous uproar.
Saying what?
About killing the world's oldest living organism.
What? I thought we were just saying, I think it was the oldest living tree.
It's both. It's the oldest tree and it's the oldest organism.
Wait. You mean that the oldest continuously living animal, shrub, mushroom, are you sure about this?
What you just said was this
is the oldest living continuous individual alive on the planet.
I know what I said. This tree was older than any other tree on the planet, older than the oldest sponge, which is like 1,500 years old, older than the oldest animal, just some sort of oyster, which is 405 years old, older than any other living thing on the entire planet.
Oh, God.
Where do we go from there?
So where does that leave Mr. Curry? So what happened to him?
Well, right after this happened, Curry pretty much stopped doing research on trees. He basically studied salt flats for the rest of his career. Big, treeless salt flats. And aside from that little Nova clip that we played before, he hasn't really ever gone on record talking about this. So it's hard for us to say like how he really felt about it. But there was this one moment, he was being interviewed by a TV reporter, like about his salt flats research.
And this would have been in the probably the late 80s, early 90s.
Years and years after the whole tree incident.
All of a sudden, out of a clear blue sky, the television reporter asked him, "Oh, aren't you the Curry who killed the world's oldest tree?" He was completely ambushed. And Curry just turned his back and ran away.
Ooh, so that's a stain that's just never going to wear off somebody. But on the other hand, he did have the incredible misfortune to kill the oldest living organism on our planet.
Yeah, but this is 25 years later, and he's still getting hassled about this tree.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about one tree here.
Well, no, we're talking about the tree here.
Right, but
the thing about a tree that lasts for almost 4,000 years.
More than that.
5,000 years.
Almost 5,000 years, sure.
Is that it is a repository. It is a talisman for 5,000 years of Earth history.
But, I mean, would it be any less bad if the tree were 3,500 years old? This is just one more old thing.
No, it isn't. It's the oldest of
You're
all.
You're taking, like, the Guinness Book of World Records.
Oh, you keep making me into, like, a Ripley's Believe It or Not guy, but no.
That's exactly what you're being.
No. When you've been around longer than everybody else, there's a sort of
which
big presumption.
Which I've never experienced.
Yeah.
Well, have you?
Well, I'm a lot older than you. I walk in here and I look at you and I feel pity for all the things you don't know. Consider what the tree must have felt.
I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time.
That was reporter Pat Walters.
The right thing, but it must have used the wrong line.
And we're happy to say that since our original broadcast of the story, a new, oldest living tree has been found. It's also a bristlecone pine, also in the White Mountains. And its current age, according to Dr. Peter Brown of the Rocky Mountain Tree Ring Research Group, is just about 5,060 years old, which makes it actually older than Don Curry's tree when it was cut down. So Don Curry, if you're out there listening from the afterlife, you can now rest in peace. We'll continue in a moment.
Hi, this is Chuck from Albany, New York. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.